what are they seeing when they quit someone that we're not seeing? Or what goes on?
I don't think any of us, anyone, I mean, this would make the world a very scary place, and sadly it's a reality for so many of us. But I don't think that anyone wants to believe the people who we trust in our safety and with our lives, that of our children, and that we give them extraordinary powers that we don't give other human beings, the power to take our freedoms, the power to use force, the power even to shoot and kill, and each of those powers that I just described as necessary powers that police officers need to have. I don't think that anyone wants to believe what each of us saw on that video, that that happens, that police officers, any police officer, would just go out and lie. I mean, what do you do, and what an unsafe place it would feel to live when those who are sworn to protect you become predatory. The other reality is that, you know, I remember this back, same conversation 25 years ago when the first big video came out, and it was a shock to most middle America, Rodney King in California, and I was living in California at the time. And I remember the very different reactions. First, majority white folks, middle America, it was a shock. But for black folks, and that's why this isn't a new conversation, we're still having the same conversation. The only thing that was different, and now it's a lot less different with the ubiquity of video and technology, was that it was actually caught on film. And yet, as you just said, despite that video, since 25 years ago, all white juries, Simi Valley, acquitted those officers. 2 years ago, I watched, and I still have nightmares about this, Eric Garner, an officer, choked the life out of him before our eyes on video. I don't have an answer. We still live in such socially segregated worlds. 2016, socially segregated worlds. And if we look at images, and if I start just like throwing out the name, drug dealer, dope dealer, gangbanger, crack baby, crack mama, racial images are evoked. Despite the reality, and I cite these stats all the time, if we're comparing white kids to black kids, studies show that white kids use cocaine at rates 7 times that of black kids, heroin 8 times that of black kids, and get this, white high school kids sell drugs at 34% greater rates than black kids, but yet black youth are 48 times more likely than white youth to go to prison for drugs. I teach at University of Chicago. I went to college here at Northwestern in Evanston. And when I was at Northwestern, after my junior year, I worked an internship in the Cook County Public Defender's Office, and this was back in the early 80s. This was in Skokie, so right here, your neighbor. I would have thought that only criminals in the world were black and brown. I saw black and brown folks in shackles, all charged with drug crimes. And yet when I went back to my campus, I saw white kids selling and using drugs all the time. And none of my peers in the same thing at U of C, my students who I'm teaching right now, back talking about two different constitutions, two different worlds, my students just a few blocks away, my daughters just less than 5 blocks away, are not stopped, searched, and treated with suspicion of being a criminal every day.
What would it take for the officers who are on the scene, for them to see that other officer as a murderer? Not one of them, but a murderer.
I think what you see and what you saw there, and it should shock all of our moral sensibilities, but what's most shocking is not just pointing the finger at each and every one of those, and those officers should be prosecuted. And matter of fact, one of the things we did was we've just brought last week, or maybe my days are blending together now, it was this week, a petition to appoint a special prosecutor to ensure that those crimes are prosecuted. And one of the ways in which that we change things is that you end the state of impunity. You end the state of impunity where you abide by this code of silence, not going to be tolerated anymore. You retaliate, you lie to protect a fellow officer, you'll be punished, you'll lose your job. empower the good officers. 80% of the force or more aren't doing this stuff. Most of that 80% don't want anything to do with those officers who are. They don't want to work with them, but they're not going to report them, because if they do, and it's like, I remember one of the things, and I went to a seminar, and they were showing an old 60 Minutes take, and it was an Ed Bradley thing, and it was a really powerful story about the code of silence, and it was trying to, you know, teach officers, no, this isn't the way to go. But I took away a different message, and I think every officer took away a different message too, and this is what has to change. The message that I took away, because this is what happened, they showed a few poignant stories. One, the two I remember most, one was in Riverside, California, and one was in the Bronx in New York. Both involved horrific police shootings and officers who ultimately who came forward and reluctantly and exposed this. Then later on in that video, I saw both of those same officers at a church, homeless shelter, food line, trying to get food for their families. And so if I'm an officer, do I want to be that? And I'm not, so what it takes is our collective will and the collective will of the department to say, we're not going to protect that mess. And we are going to empower the officer so that that's not, it doesn't take an extraordinary act of human courage to come forward. But that's what we do, because police officers, and these are the officers who talk to me, they hate this stuff because guess what? Just like Mike and Monica, they're walking through the same neighborhood, got to work the same neighborhood every day. You think when Officer Van Dyke shooting a kid like that, and we've all seen this, that puts other officers' lives in danger. That makes people not trust. That makes people hostile toward them. It makes it nearly impossible to solve a crime. What needs to change is a few simple things. I mean, it's just really basic. It's like, we're not going to tolerate this code of silence. We're going to protect officers who come forward. We're going to prosecute anyone who retaliates against them. We're going to honor those officers for the heroes that they are. And we're going to address those, the smaller percentage, but it's not a problem of a few bad apples. It's our systems of impunity that have allowed to protect those bad apples, to stop letting the minority of abusive officers abuse the most vulnerable among us. That's when things change. But it changes only when we all start to care. I was really taken by when young folks in Chicago on Black Friday engaged in mass protests, Michigan Avenue, shut down all this stuff. But one of the things that, I mean, and one, it brought a tear to my eye seeing the power and what the kids were doing. But the other thing that just told me this is a different day, too, was the reaction of the store owners. The reactions mostly in the past were, police, mayor, you got to do something about these people, meaning you got to lock them up. Well, instead I started hearing, mostly what I started hearing was, you got to do something about the problem, about why these kids are protesting.
Are there any departments that you know of that's implemented programs already?
I think there are a lot of good things happening. I met a few months ago, when I said I'm hopeful, one of the reasons I'm hopeful, because I meet every day good police officers here too in Chicago. I meet officers that make, you know, who I look up to, who I admire. But I met a police chief though from Richmond, California. I used to live in Oakland, and I used to live in the Bay Area there too. Richmond's a city right next to Oakland, a few hundred thousand people. City, predominantly minority, was high crime, and absolutely no trust between police and community. In about the 8 or 9 years, Chief Magnus, and one of the things he became kind of famous, this is when I called him out of the blue, I had to meet him, openly gay white man on the street protesting Black Lives Matter. I said, I got to talk to this man. And I did, and I asked him about what you're doing, and he talked about the kinds of things they're doing to change the mindset. And there are the things that I was talking about basic respect, but it also means putting your money where your mouth was. And so what he's doing is not so how a lot of departments are stats-driven. You, the more arrests, the more people you shake down, the more people you stop, that's good, you get the numbers, that's how you move up. In Richmond now, you get points for resolving situations without the need for arrest. You get points for getting out of your car, working in the community, forming relationships, solving problems. If we're actually implementing systems where you move up in the department and these are the values of the department and we set a tone, that's why leadership like that matters. And what I've seen in Richmond then, so this was a place where there's absolutely no trust, and I'm not going to say everything is hunky-dory there. I'm just using this as one example, and there are a lot of other examples. But right now, violent crime is at all-time lows. Complaints against police are at all-time lows. And it's been 8 years since an officer has shot somebody in Richmond, California. We can do better. I'm seeing it. A couple of practical things to do, very practical things. One is something that I just mentioned. Don't let the police department destroy. I mean, right now, and there are people who are sitting in prison who, I sit on a commission, what's called the Illinois Torture Commission. And we hear and we adjudicate and investigate claims of police torture and claims that in Chicago have dated back to the infamous John Burge era, 1970s, 80s. Each and every one of those records, for us to do our job, the Department of Justice is coming here and doing a pattern and practice investigation. I don't know how they do an investigation if the evidence to investigate is all destroyed and doesn't exist. I don't know how I do my job as a commissioner for the Illinois Torture Commission and adjudicate claims of torture if you destroy all the evidence of the torture. So let's just start with something real concrete. Move your legislature to pass that law. Make your folks act. Say, it's low, low, low hanging fruit. In Chicago, among the things that we're doing and will be introducing will be an ordinance to replace what's called IPRA, the so-called independent police review authority, and that's the agency that is charged with investigating police misconduct, brutality complaints, shootings, force complaints, has been ineffective isn't the right word. Because 10 years ago, actually, I wrote an article, and I think the title was all wrong because I talked about what I characterized as a broken system. I guess what I've learned is that the system isn't broken. It's doing exactly what's intended to do. And just like we talk about states of crises, and this isn't a crisis. A crisis is a departure from the norm. What we're dealing with are the same issues and problems that have existed for so many years. So one thing support this ordinance too. It will call for an independent police monitor that will truly be transparent, accountable, independent, and responsive and selected by and accountable to people most impacted by police abuse. But to me, it starts with just this basic thing, and this isn't just about police. I see it in my own children's school. I see it in every college campus, predominantly white college campus around the nation. And as non-black folks in this room, honesty means also acknowledging our own privilege. I'm privileged too. I wouldn't be standing before you. I wouldn't have the privilege of teaching law at University of Chicago but for the lighter shade of my skin. My daughter, who attends a fancy, fancy college, freshman year, Kenyatta and I couldn't be proud of her, will brag until the day is long, wouldn't be where she is. And she's worked hard and all that, but she wouldn't be where she is without privilege. None of us wants, and none of us in this room wants to admit that it's not just because of our hard work, and my daughter Elijah, she's worked hella hard, and because of our merit that we are where we are. But I think if we want to start changing things, it begins by looking at our own selves and our own families, our own backyards, acknowledging that and seeing how that impacts all of our lives, and then speaking out against it, and speaking out against the very systems. And it's not just about intentional racism. I mean, the more pernicious stuff is the structural racism that results in, still in America now, which is just ridiculous. We have more people, more black folks in prison today that were imprisoned at the height of apartheid in southern Africa. We have more black folks in prison today in 2016 than before the Civil War in 1800s in America. So it starts with us. I think the real risk, and this is, and part of what I'm hearing also in this room, the what can we do question is, there's such, I mean, the issues of racism that have been with us and been with us, these aren't new problems and been with us for so long, that there's a tendency for us to almost shrug our shoulders or throw up our hands in futility. And it turns into, and I think this is the risk, of a real moral paralysis, that when there are such deep problems like this, we look for the big transformative solution. And I guess what I'm just trying to get at is that there's some basic fundamental things that we can do, all of us can do, and it starts with honesty, accountability, holding our folks accountable and making things transparent, and treating people with respect, and it will do a world of difference. So honesty, one of the things, and Josh mentioned that about what we did, and this is a real transfer of power, and this is a first step and a necessary step. So we fought in one of the legal cases that we brought, and this was on behalf of, in an era, so you have lots of major press with lots of, or I shouldn't say, but still corporate media utterly failed to do this or to bring this. Independent journalists hanging on by a shoestring, Jamie Calvin then gets not big law, but then a legal aid clinic and a bunch of law students to come and just fight for this basic principle that police misconduct records belong to the public. And then after establishing that principle, police misconduct records belong to the people. You know, the same kind of first principle, we endow folks with that much power. Guess what? With that power comes responsibility and accountability to the public. So we create then this database that's accessible to everybody, and we're going to try to build that database, and we'll have, if we're successful in keeping this bonfire from happening, data on every single incident of police misconduct from 1967 through the present available to each and every person, everybody. We can see then these potential patterns and hold departments accountable for not putting in place. It's, as I said, indefensible that we refuse to look at patterns. Police departments refuse to look at patterns when investigating police abuse. So the first step is honesty and transparency, and those are some of the laws that we're fighting for, too, and things that everyone can stand up for. It's just basic democratic principles, how you monitor and each of our responsibility for overseeing our government to ensure that it's acting in the public interest. But, so this great transformative thing, making this information first time in the nation available like this, nothing like this exists anywhere. It exists in Chicago right now. But that's not change in and of itself. I mean, there's the knowledge is power thing, but what it does is it creates the conditions for change. It by itself, making this stuff public, making it transparent, that doesn't end sexism, it doesn't end racism in the police department, it doesn't end the code of silence, and it certainly doesn't end patterns of police abuse, but what it does is it gives each and every one of us the power to address those things. And so it starts with just fighting for basic honesty, being honest ourselves, and then acting on that and holding these are our officials. We put them there. We can take them out.
It's also possible to imagine worlds where the standard for discharging a weapon are different than they are now.
It's all about the reasonableness of an officer's actions. Is it reasonable? And part of the training that officers get, it's like the shoot, don't shoot training. And this, back to the mentality that I was talking about, of this mindset, of this warrior mindset, if I think that everyone's out to get me, it's certainly reasonable, and particularly now in an era where guns are so prevalent and we're legalizing guns in major ways, where if everyone legally can have a gun on the street, it doesn't take but a second for me to pull that gun, and then, yes, legally then, was it reasonable? Could a reasonable officer believe that they may be in fear for their life and have a reasonable fear for their life? But I think what Josh was intimating, you can imagine, and we can imagine a world with a different standard. As a matter of fact, there are worlds with different standards, and pretty much everywhere but the United States, or I should say at least most of Europe, has a standard where the use of deadly force is only used when it's necessary. not when it's reasonable, only as a matter of last resort. Imagine a world where human life is treated as precious, as something from God as it is, and where we use deadly force only as a matter of last resort. Nobody shoots and kills the number of people that we do in America. No police department, no law enforcement agency in the world comes close.
I lost a nephew to gun violence by police. I've gone to so many funerals that I've taken a leave of absence from the ministry because I cannot take a funeral every week of a young person that's been shot and killed by gunfire. And the number of shootings and killings, let's not talk about just Chicago, it's right here in Eaton.
As I've talked today, have lots of ideas for solutions. I guess the purpose and what I see as the fundamental purpose of those forums are for folks to speak from their own experiences and their own knowledge and to bring that and to bring those experiences to this task force. But it's not just to the task force, because I think that task force also needs to be held accountable. If you look at the task force, it's made up of four former prosecutors and one former public defender, only one person who has, at least in my view, any credibility in the community. Only one person. Four former law enforcement, four former prosecutors, and one former public defender, and this is an independent task force representative of the community. So I think it's not just what you ask, but I think it's, so just shoot. Within the last 2 days, there was an announcement made by the mayor and by at least some of that task force of this new policy. And my understanding, at least in terms of community input, when folks were interviewed, no one advocated for that. I think it's critically important that you also hold this task force accountable for make it transparent, make them make it transparent, and hold them accountable for what they do. And I guess I just want to express again my gratitude to everybody here and really for JRC to opening its doors to me and to everyone in this community to have this kind of a conversation, because I do think this conversation is more than just talk. I think these are the kind of conversations that are necessary, and conversations across race, across class, and across culture dealing with these more difficult issues, so that we're not in a state of moral paralysis and we're not holding up our hands and just shrugging our shoulders. So I just want to thank you and thank you for caring.